Okay, it's time. I'm going to start. We'll see if no one else comes on. That's fine. More people in any event listen online. It's April 7th, and tonight's the last night of the semester. Finishing up very quickly, hopefully within 15 minutes, on Revue Venkatz. Don't hold me to it, Shlomo, but that's the plan. And then moving on to Rabbi the Ben Ishchai, which will take us to the end of tonight. I want to begin by pointing out a few very interesting things and responding to a question, actually a comment, two comments. Someone asked me regarding last class's talk. I was speaking about Rabbi Katz from Passaic, New Jersey, and the hashgacha on the ShopRite hot dogs. So someone was interested that all ShopRite hot dogs are kosher. No, there were two types of ShopRite hot dogs with different color wrapping, and one of them was kosher. If you looked at the wrapper, you saw that both the Shofar hot dogs and the ShopRite hot dogs were made in the exact same plant. I don't know if they were the same price, and just some were packaged under ShopRite and some were packaged under Shofar. But like I said, in those days, that was before Glatt Kosher. And in my area, we all ate Rabbi Leon Katz's ShopRite or Shofar kosher hot dogs. I don't know if they were more kosher than Hebrew National, but as I said, growing up, we never ate, at least in my house, we didn't eat Hebrew National, but we did eat the Shofar. Then Rabbi Yonasan Rossman, who listens, not live, but listens to the tapes and often sends me very interesting comments, he sent me the following regarding last class's talk and the year class before. I see Yisrael is on, so this is relevant to what you asked about Ramosha Feinstein's attitude toward Zionism. And he told, and by the way, someone also who's on who should have a lot more, I guess, reliability on this, being part of the family, told me that my description of Ramosha was right on. But he pointed out the sefer, which I have, but I've forgotten about it. This sefer called Rishumei Aharon. There's volumes 1 and volume 2. This is by Rav Aaron Felder, who was a Talmud Muvhak, a real outstanding Talmud of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now remember, Rav Moshe Feinstein, his yeshiva never really developed into one of the great yeshivas, and there weren't that many people who, were learning continuously, came from other places and everything to learn in MTJ, but there were a number of people, and they became close to him. Rabbi Greenblatt was the one we spoke about, and Rabbi Felder was very close to Rav Moshe, was with him every single day upstairs, speaking to him about matters, and he recorded a number of things he heard. And Rabbi Rossman calls my attention to Volume 2, page 6, about the Israeli Day Parade. This is pretty unbelievable. By the way, there's all sorts of great stuff on all these pages. After I read you this and the next one, I'll read you two more or three more things on it. This is on page 5, actually, at the bottom. He says that the Moetzes Gedolia Torah of Agudas Yisrael decided not to participate in the Israeli Day Parade. Obviously, this is not unusual that the Moetzes Gedolia Torah would decide not to. When I went to Rabbi Teitz's yeshiva, JEC in Elizabeth, we were not allowed as a school to go to the Israeli Day Parade. Now they do go. And I asked Rabbi Teitz once why we couldn't go. I know why we couldn't go to this Marches for Soviet Jewry, because he thought that this was a negative thing, that the best way to help the Jews of the Soviet Union was through quiet diplomacy. So I asked him, though, why can't we go to the Israeli Day Parade? And he says, we're not a Talmud Torah. You know, that's for the Talmud Torahs to do. No, we're a yeshiva. What this means, I think, is that even though he was a Zionist, for all his friends in Agudas Yisrael, he didn't want, and Agudas Rabbanim, he didn't want them to see our school as a typical Zionist school like Flatbush and the rest. So we never went. By the way, Yisrael, I don't know what you mean over there when you're talking about the goatee. I'm not sure which rabbi you're referring to. Okay, so Agudas Yisrael decided not to have anything to do with it. And Rabbi Felder says, but he heard that Rav Moshe wrote a letter, a hamlatza, a letter, a positive letter for people going on the parade, an encouraging letter. So he asked him, what's going on? If you know, are you opposed to it? Because he was in those days the Agud, Motzis Gadol Torah of Agudas Yisrael wouldn't do anything without Rav Moshe. And he said that, yes, it's true, he wrote this letter, but he wrote Michtav Parva. He wrote a Parv letter for those who already decided to go march. I guess the situation was some people were marching, came to Rav Moshe and said, we're marching, can you write us, or our shul's marching, can you write us a letter of encouragement? And rather, as many other rabbis who would have said, no, and of course not, he wrote him a letter, you know, that it should be for a zechus, I guess, for Eretz Yisrael that you're marching, something like that. So that's very interesting, I thought. On the same page, he tells that he once went to with Rav Moshe to do a wedding at Lincoln Square Synagogue. And when he went in, he showed Rav Moshe the machitza. Those who were there know, I don't know the new shul when they rebuilt it, but the old one, it just was a glass. And men and women could sit right next to each other. And it says Rav Moshe laughed. He said, that's a machitza? But they did the wedding anyway. And the next thing he called my attention to is on the same volume, page 10. This relates to, I mentioned, I think it was two classes ago, that there was this rabbi. He's actually a leading, not a halachic figure, but more of a hashkafic figure in the Haredi world. And after the Merkaz Rav massacre, he had this vision, I guess it is, that it was because that the religious Zionists, were attached to Zionism. That's why the punishment came down and, struck them down. I mean, something completely idiotic and offensive. He pointed out that Rav Moshe said as follows. And by the way, this Rabbi Rossman has written two Sfarim. He's really a very talented young Talmud Chacham. So if anyone's interested in his two Sfarim, one on Chukos HaGoyim, and the other escapes me. I think maybe on clothes, men and women. I have them. I don't want to get up and get them, but I have both of them. So a real Talmud Chacham. Flatbush graduate, if I'm not mistaken, but a real Talmud Chacham. He says that, this is Rabbi Felder records, that this young woman who had cancer came to Rav Moshe, and she wanted to know why she had this. Why was she suffering? What did she do? Or what was the reason for this punishment? And Rav Moshe said to her that we can't ask a question like that. We don't know the answers. This isn't something that anyone can know. Okay, that we can appreciate and understand. But then he says as follows, and this is what Rabbi Rossman points out is really amazing, and I agree. He says, even when Chazal are recorded as giving reasons for why things happened, these are not absolute reasons. He says, these are just hashara krova. This is just their best estimate, their best guess, their assumptions of what could have caused it. And as Rabbi Rossman points out, can you imagine today if anyone were to get up and say that the reason, when Chazal said that the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed because of Sinas Chinam, that's only, that's their best guess. They would they think you're crazy, and that's disrespectful to Chazal. But you have Rav Moshe here saying that even Chazal were not prophets, and they didn't have a direct line to God, and they were just giving their best assumptions better than our assumptions. But I would say that Chazal at least have the authority to try to give reasons. And notice when Chazal are giving reasons, they're talking about everyone, themselves too. They're saying, we are responsible, we did this, that's why this is happening. And whether it's absolutely true or not, it's really irrelevant, because it's giving people, everyone, a way to improve themselves. And when they tell the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, they're focusing on themselves. It's a lot different when someone gives, there's a tragedy and someone doesn't say, it's because of what we did, but it's because of what you did. That's a very different situation. By the way, this book, as I said, let me just read you a couple things that I think you'll find really interesting. This is on page 8. We could spend a whole two or three classes just going through each one of these. And it's a very thin book, as you can see right here. But I'll give you a couple others. He was asked, and this is very relevant today when we have different tzedakahs and there's limited money, what goes first when you have tzedakah? Everyone should get, you should give tzedakah to all sorts of organizations, but If you're giving $1,000, maybe you can give $900 to one and split the rest, whatever, however you do it, what should get the most? And he says, tzedakah for students in the yeshiva. But not yeshiva gadol, he says, tinoko shel beit rabban, your local day school. That has to be the community school, I guess we could put it in our language, has to be the primary tzedakah. And by the way, that in my town, that's because Rav Schechter came to West Orange last year, and he spoke about priorities in tzedakah, and he said that this should be the priority, that everything else should be secondary, and that the primary tzedakah, he made it seem as if it's not even an option, that it's halacha, that you can't, but you can't send your money out. Your primary money has to stay in the community. But then he did say that you could have people whose community is not necessarily where they live. I think maybe some people were not so happy about that. He said, for example, if your son goes to yeshiva, let's say he goes to Neri Yisrael, that could be your primary tzedakah, even though it's not your community, because it's primary to you. But he basically, the point of his talk, and I think that's why they brought him in, was that money should not be going out. People should not be giving all this money to schools that have nothing to do with our community. Then he quotes, he says that there was a story of a Rosh Yeshiva Echad, one Rosh Yeshiva. I don't know why he does. Everyone knows the story, but he leaves it a little ambiguous, who together with other Jews was captured. We're talking about Rav Huttner. When Rav Huttner was on the airplane and it was captured by the Palestinian terrorists and it was flown to Jordan, it says the students of this Rosh Yeshiva wanted to use all sorts of means to free Rav Huttner. I think this is all above Maisa in the sense, not above Maisa, they wanted to, but I think it's all really nonsense. You know, they got together, they wanted to see if they could free him. What could they do? What they're going to offer, that they're going to approach the terrorists, they're going to offer them money. I mean, the whole thing was crazy. How would they get in touch with these terrorists who were on the tarmac in Jordan? But they did. The fact is that they did want to get together and use their influence to try to free Rav Huttner. Now, just we've spoken about this before. If you can only imagine the Chilul Hashem this would have caused, that Rav Huttner is being freed and everyone else is staying there. The job of a Rosh Yeshiva, of a rabbi, is to remain with the people. But and they didn't ask Rav Huttner. They were just going to do that. Although there is controversy about Rav Huttner's role on the plane. I mean, he was separated. The story is that his son-in-law, I think it was, who was on the plane with him, let the terrorists know that he was significant, that he was moved to the front of the plane. But I'm not here to judge or just tell you what the facts are. But they came to Rav Moshe if they were permitted to do this. And Rav Moshe said immediately, they cannot do this. And listen to reason, not because of Chilul Hashem. I would have said, perhaps it would make a terrible Chilul Hashem. Because after all, I mean, I would think, in that situation, really, it's every man for himself. If you can rescue someone, I don't know that you shouldn't rescue someone if there's other people, just because there's others you can't. But whatever Moshe say, Ein lahaktim hatzalas harosh yeshiva latzalas shayu yudim nimsim shav. You don't rescue a Rosh Yeshiva. Make him go first before the other Jews that are found there. Rav Moshe is saying that the Rosh Yeshiva's life does not go before the others. I think plenty of rabbis would have disagreed with that. If you look at the list of who is saved under certain circumstances, they don't actually say a Rosh Yeshiva goes first. They describe in Masachet Horayot, who goes first. And they don't say Rosh Yeshiva, but we know throughout history that people have assumed that the learned person goes first. And we have saw examples of this in the Holocaust. And yet Rav Moshe says that we do not rescue a Rosh Yeshiva before someone else. I wish Rav Moshe was here to ask him. He might say that who says the Rosh Yeshiva, just because he has more learning, is a more pious person? The simple Jew might be more pious and might have more zechuyos. The Rosh Yeshiva might be single and might be in his 80s, and the simple Jew might have 10 children. There's all these variables here, but all I can say, these are all my speculation, but the fact reported is that Rav Moshe's reason was not because of the Chilul Hashem, was because you don't rescue a Rosh Yeshiva before someone else. He also, on page 9, he was asked about Daf Yomi, another thing we've spoken about, and he says Daf Yomi is very good, but for those people who can learn Torah in a more serious manner, they should not do Daf Yomi. And for them, that's considered Bittul Torah. And finally, he was asked, someone wanted to do a book about difficult questions, religious questions, and then give the answers. And Rav Moshe said to him, this is great, I think, you can write the book giving the answers, but don't have a book giving the questions, like not like a Kuzari. Because in general, the questions, you know, we don't have all the answers. And often the questions, Rav Moshe said, are more difficult than the answers. That is, the questions are stronger, yoter chazakot, from the answers. So all you're going to do is you're going to raise questions in people's minds. So you have to find a way to write the book that gets the idea across, but not to do it in a way that you put the questions there as well. He also quotes here that Rav Moshe was against people going out doing Kiruv in these far-off places in the middle of nowhere. He says the Jews there, there's all sorts of Yichus problems. And then he finally says, this last one I'll give you, that Rav Moshe did not like what Lubavitch does by stopping people on the street, asking him to put on tefillin, asking him to shake a luav. He doesn't say why Rav Moshe didn't like it, but that's... Anyone who's interested, there's many, many more of these things. Okay, with that, let me put this down and let us begin. I said that before we end with Rav Reuven Katz, I want to call your attention to another thing he wrote and talk about these two rabbis in the picture here. So let me take a few minutes. This rabbi here, I don't know if anyone has heard of him, but in his day, he was a great, great rabbi in America. His name was Rav Aaron Yudalevitz. Next to him was a rabbi named Gavriel Zev Margolios. You can go on HebrewBooks.org. You can see their Sfarim. These were really top-of-the-line rabbis. Great Talmid Chachamim. Yes, almost correct. And who he is. Elgin Street Shul. Let me say as follows. I'm enough of a Lamdin to know when I see weak Torah. That is Torah that's not, it's not such high quality. That I can know. It's a good quality to know, though, what you don't know. When I'm not nowhere near good, high enough of a Lamdin to be able to talk about whose Torah is greater than another. Once you get into the major leagues, for me, it all looks the same. So I have to rely on the people who really know this. And people who can, much greater people than me, who can distinguish between when you get to the top of the line Torah scholars have told me that Rav Aaron Yudalevitz, you're dealing with a real genius Torah scholar, someone whose Torah learning is really top level, one of the greatest scholars in America at the time. And what can I say? So why am I mentioning him? Well, both of these rabbis were involved in a huge machlokas. This is all leading up, telling you a little bit about them before I get to how this connects to Rav Reuven Katz. What was the machlokas? We probably have all heard of the Agudas Rabbanim, this organization called Agudas Rabbanim, in which you had the old-fashioned European Rabbanim in America in before World War II, even after World War II. Really, it was a very important, active organization, even to the 60s, early 70s. During World War II, they did a lot. But in the 20s, and into the 30s, there was another rabbinic organization. There are actually two more. One was called Knesset Rabbanim, and one was called Degel Rabbanim, Degel Yisrael. And they really sort of were merged as it became one. I don't know how much difference there was, but Rav Yudalevitz and Gavriel Zev Margolios were members of the Knesset Rabbanim, Degel Yisrael, and Rav Yudalevitz was really the leader of it. He was a rabbi in Lithuania, that is Rabbi Yudalevitz, and then he comes to England. He was chased out of England. I've told this story before. I even wrote it up. And subsequent to writing it up on the Sfarim blog, I was contacted by someone, an elderly man in Manchester, who records that the story is known. He heard the story when he was a young person. He heard the story 50 years ago by one of the old-timers, that the Balabatim, or maybe one Balabas, it's hard to know, they arranged that the carriage that was supposed to come, I guess the carriage would come maybe every day at the same time to pick him up for davening or whatever, that the carriage to come pick up Rabbi Yudalevitz, they put a few prostitutes in this carriage so that when they came up to his house and he went out and opened the carriage, who would be waiting there for him? None other than the prostitutes. Now, they were so he left Manchester. He came to America. He was in Boston for a while. Then he came to New York. He actually taught at Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. We have the person who put out some of his Torah works told me that he got from YU two smichas he gave when he was there. And then he was crowned the Rav of the Agudas Kehilos. There's a number of Kehilos in New York, and he was their chief rabbi. This is a picture of him and Rabbi Gavriel Zev Margolios standing outside the White House, if you can believe it. They visited President Calvin Coolidge, representing the Knesset Rabbanim. Coolidge had just given a famous speech. It's come down as a famous speech called his Coolidge Speech on Tolerance. It was a speech against the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, and they went to meet with the president to express their appreciation for his nice comments about the value of tolerance. So what was the controversy? The big machlokas in those days between rabbis was often over hashgachas. That's how they made their living. It's not like today where we pay our rabbis. It's around this season. I mean, some of your shuls that you still might have rabbis who make a living selling chametz. But in the modern shuls, it's not expected that the rabbi should take any money for doing things like that or doing funerals. It's nice. Usually they have a discretionary fund, but not into their pocket. But in those days, this is how they survived. And there was big machokas between the rabbis. A whole book has been written out, Harold Gastworth, Fraud, Corruption, and Holiness, I think is the name of it. And you can read all about what I'm going to mention right now. One of the big machokas was between the Knesset Rabbanim and the Agudas Rabbanim, because the Agudas Rabbanim made a takana that they saw there was so much problems with kashrus and unreliable rabbis and mashkichim and forgery of pumbas. The pumba, the older people my age and up can remember, when we were young, you didn't buy Empire chickens the way you have it now, just packaged, you bought the chicken, but they had this metal thing that was connected onto on the wing usually, and that was the sign that it was kosher. Oh, and there were scandals that there were stolen pumbas, and people put it on treif. But the people at my age and older can remember the pumbas, the little metal pieces that were stuck on it. In order to stop the scandals and the problems, the Agudas Rabbanim made a takana that still exists to this day. And it was because it was reaffirmed every couple of decades, or Moshe Feinstein, when he was head of Agudas Rabbanim, reaffirmed it, that a factory, a slaughterhouse that does non-kosher cannot also do kosher. There was a great fear that if one guy has a slaughterhouse and he's doing kosher on one part of it, or even one whole different section of it, and kosher in another one, that there'd be mix-ups, there'd be problems. So they made this takana. And that, by the way, becomes, by World War II, that becomes standard. Anyone who has a non-kosher slaughterhouse cannot also have a kosher slaughterhouse. In fact, I'd have to check it. I don't even think it's referring to the same. I think you can't even own two different ones, even if they're in separate places. But obviously, certainly not when they're right next to each other. This was really not an issue in America until about 6 or 7 years ago. The Star K actually gave a hashgacha on a plant that had kosher and non-kosher, and there was a huge controversy about it because the Star K was accused, correctly, of breaking with this takana that had bound American Jewry for some 60 years. I forgot the name. If anyone remembers the name, type it in, of this meat, this hot dogs. It didn't last very long. They were forced to back out. I do remember very vividly that I was even there the day this happened. I happened to be in the supermarket in the shop right in West Orange. I saw the guy. There's a guy. We have a kosher butcher there. He was removing this glatt kosher salami, hot dogs, whatever it was, under the Star K Hashkacha. And I asked him, why are you taking it out of the kosher aisle? He was going to put it in the regular aisle, like with the Hebrew National, because we have a special aisle, which everything under that is under the Hashkacha, give approval by the local Vod. And he told me that the Vod had instructed him to remove it. So in other words, the Vod, and I don't think the people who run the Vod of my town have ever heard of this takana or anything like that, but they had obviously been told by the OU or someone else that this product was in violation of the takana in America and it should be removed. And therefore, it was regarded as like Hebrew National. It was, unless you're a Baltimore person and accept the Star K, people were being told not to eat it. The Knesset Rabbanim rejected this takana. And they wrote about how this is a nonsensical takana. If you look at the Rishonim, you look at the Talmud, whoever heard of such a thing that a non-Jew can't have two plants, one kosher, one non-kosher? And they rejected the idea that there were problems that needed to be solved. They said all you need are good mashkichim, good rabbanim. And this became a huge feud between the Knesset Rabbanim and their slaughterhouses and their shochtim and their mashkichim versus the Agudas Rabbanim, each one attacking the other one. It got to be very ugly because the rabbis were attacking each other in the worst sort of language. Then, once the Knesset Rabbanim was out of the picture, the Agudas Rabbanim were running the show, but not for long, because new people started getting involved, the OU and the OK. Maybe the Sforim blog post I'm going to have after the next one, I will print something that the OK wrote about, that the Agudas Rabbanim wrote about the OK Hashkacha, saying it is 100% not reliable. There were these feuds between the old-time rabbis and the hashgachas. Okay, so why else is Rabbi Yudel Levitz controversial? Because he wrote the following book. I'm going to pull it up now. Av the Chachma. It has five psakim, halacha l'maisa. Notice it says underneath, it says he's the Rav HaKolel. That means he's the chief rabbi of the Agudas HaKilos of New York. And it says before that he was rabbi in Boston and in Manchester and in Kapulia in Lithuania, Russia. The first thing deals with Chalitza. What is his psak on Chalitza? Sefer is published in 1927. He held, and he explained in great detail, even before this book had been published, he had his view was known, and he had written about it. This is a defense of his view, that a woman who is in need of a chalitza, otherwise she's an aguna, she can have another woman, it's not a man can't do it, a woman can have another woman be her messenger to receive the chalitza. This is a big deal, because you had in those days, you had people in Russia, and someone in America, let's say, is in Russia, and the husband dies, the woman's an aguna, because has to get chalitza from the brother-in-law who's in America. How is she going to do that? This would solve the problem. And this created a huge dispute, with the rabbis almost unanimously rejecting it. The Maharsham, the great Maharsham, raised it as a possibility, but didn't accept it. And with the exception of one or two minor rabbis, no one accepted it, his psak. The Knesset Rabbanim was forced to not defend Rabbi Yudel Levitz, his halacha l'maisa, but they were forced to defend him as a person, because he was being attacked as someone trying to uproot Torah law. Rabbi Eskolsky, who's one of the leaders, wrote a whole piece that Rabbi Yudel Levitz is a great tzaddik. He went to the rabbis, he went to the Agudas Rabbanim, he gave them his arguments and said, refute me, refute me. And he did the same thing about the rabbis. All Rabbi Yudel Levitz is asking for is for people to explain why he's wrong. The Rogatchover really ripped him to shreds. Was very disrespectful to him, but the Rabbi Yudel Levitz was not one to take abuse. If you look in Av B'Chachma, in the Sefer, you see the way he responds to the Rogatchover. I don't think anyone ever spoke this way to the Rogatchover. He writes about the Rogatchover. The Rogatchover thinks that he's the greatest in the world. He's mevato everyone, even the Vilna Gaon. He poo-poos the Vilna Gaon. And who is this person? He thinks that he can determine Torah law for everyone. And he goes on and on. He calls him a mebubal, a mushuga. He calls him a crazy man, and etc., etc. And that was the great dispute over chalitza. So how does Rabbi Katz come in to play a part in this? Because this went on for a few years. Let me delete this here and pull him back up. Before I even go further, let me say, I have a big problem with this idea, and the problem isn't a halachic problem. Again, this is all over my head. You know, the dispute they're having about detailed matters of chalitza, I wouldn't even pretend to understand who's getting the better of the argument. But for me, it's simple. This is not a new problem. This has been a problem. We have tshuvas dealing with chalitza going back to medieval times. And we've had issues of where the woman couldn't get it, and she was an aguna. If you don't see any mention of this in medieval times, Rabbi Yudel Levitz's idea, if you don't see any mention in it by the Shulchan Aruch or anyone else, if the Noda Yehuda doesn't mention it, he dealt with chalitza issues. If you don't see the Chasam Sofer mentioning it, normally we say an argument from silence is not a good argument. But in all of these cases, when you had all these problems, if none of these great Torah scholars, leaders of the generation, who tried to solve these problems, if none of them came up with the idea that, well, let's make a shliach, then that to me is a strong argument that it's not valid, because they must have looked into it, and because the Talmud never says you can't do it, but they must have looked into it and concluded that it was unacceptable. It is true, as Rabbi Yudel Levitz believes, that every generation, yesh, as the Talmud says, yesh makom ukader bo, that every generation is able to find their own niche to create new ideas in halacha, but something so basic as this, it's difficult. So Rabbi Reuven Katz, he records, Rabbi Yudel Levitz at the end of his lifetime was living in where? Bayonne, New Jersey. That's the same town. That's where Rabbi Reuven Katz was Rav of. Now I have a paper. Oh, here's the paper. After Rabbi Yudel Levitz dies, Rabbi Reuven Katz publishes in the Morgan Journal, that was the Orthodox Yiddish paper in New York that existed for another 30 years. He said that, I want to tell you, because people were still talking about Rabbi Yudel Levitz. He died in 1930. The last 3 years of his life, he was somewhat of an outcast, because the mainstream Torah rabbis, this fact that he had been regarded as a great Torah scholar beforehand, they thought that this was basically reformism. They thought this was like a reformist idea. And he was attacked left and right, and he died not a very happy person. Rabbi Katz records, this is in Shaar Tzion, year 10, volume numbers 5 and 6, 5 to 7, page 33. He records, he wants to set the record straight, that this is recording what he wrote in the Morgan Journal, that he visited with Harav HaGaon HaManoach, with Rabbi Yudel Levitz, and Rabbi Yudel Levitz retracted his heter with regarding Chalitza with a shliach. He said that he made a mistake, and Rabbi Katz wants to spread the word that publicly, that the Rabbi Yudel Levitz wanted this to be known publicly, that no one should rely on this heter, because he himself retracted it. And Kvodo Shel HaGaon HaManoach B'Mkom Munach, his kavod remains where it is, and we have to respect him. And that's what Reuven Katz publicized. The only problem is, the week or 2 weeks later, someone replied that, what is Rabbi Reuven Katz talking about? I went to and I visited with Rabbi Yudel Levitz shortly before his death, and he told me absolutely not. He still holds of it. To which Rabbi Katz replied that I went to see him, I think it was 2 weeks before his death, and he named the witness who was with him. And at that meeting, he told us that he retracts it. So take it for what it is. That's Rabbi Yudel Levitz. And two more things I want to show you. I spoke about this book last week, the letters of Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski to Rav Reuven Katz. There are two more letters that I want to share with you, which I think are important. One appears in Volume 3. This is letter 220. And before hearing this, what he writes to Rav Reuven Katz, we have to remember that in the Haredi world, not just today, but then as well, you had two types of Haredim. You had Klal Yisrael Haredim. That is, people who really had a sense of Klal Yisrael in all its particulars. And then you had sectarian Haredim, people who were really sectarian. That is, their primary focus was on their community, and that was what was more important, and that trumped general concerns. And we spoke with Rehana Wasserman. He's a perfect example of sectarian Haredi. The things I spoke about, and when we deal with them, I'll speak more about them. Based on that, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook actually forbid Rabbi Hanan Wasserman's Sfarim, his Hashkafa Sfarim, not his Halacha, but his philosophical and Hashkafa works. Rav Tzvi Yehuda forbid them from being in the library of Merkaz HaRav, because they were so antithetical to everything Merkaz HaRav stood for in terms of Klal Yisrael. But then you have today those Haredim who have a sense of Klal Yisrael, and those Haredim who have sectarian tendencies. In this letter, Rav Chaim Ozer writes, actually, I'm not even sure why I marked it, because it's not too... Oh, yes, okay, sorry. Here it is. It's two letters here. The first thing he says is that to Rav Reuven Katz, it's Reshia Tet. He says to him that he's responding, first of all, to the conflicts going on in the Jewish world. And he says that we have to let people know that sages need to speak properly. They can't be cursing or anything like that. He's referring to the extremist elements in the land of Israel. He says, I'm not going to come out publicly about this because I don't want to make a big deal about it. That's really not what I wanted to mention to you. What I wanted to mention to you was the next letter, in which it relates to Rav Reuven Katz only tangentially, because we spoke about the plan of dividing the land of Israel. he writes to this Aguda figure, not a great rabbi, but one of the Aguda functionaries named Eyes, Aleph Yud Yud Zion in Switzerland. And he says as follows, Mr. Eyes, maybe he's a rabbi, I don't know, had written, we saw what Rav Chaim Moser wrote to Rav Reuven Katz about Rav Chanan Wasserman, that these are not matters that you can decide in Chutz La'aretz, and that you have to be concerned about the whole Yishuv, and that a decision that you give in Poland or Lithuania, it's your local community, it's not a national decision. Mr. Eyes had written to Rav Chaim Moser saying that maybe we should cast our lot with the Arabs instead of the Zionists. That is, there's going to be a state, and let's unite with the Arabs. And that's we can get a better deal from them. There's a great fear in Israel now that soon Jerusalem is going to be majority anti-Zionist, or non-Zionist at least, because you're going to have an Arab Haredi majority, and then what are you going to have? You could have coalitions in Jerusalem. I'm talking about West Jerusalem. All Jerusalem. All Jerusalem is one. It's all considered, they all vote. You could have a coalition of Arabs and Haredim. And lest you think this is an impossibility, Rav Shmuel Auerbach took out an ad, which I can send to anyone who's interested, in Arabic, appealing to the Arab voters to vote for him. His party ran in Jerusalem for the council there, and they got a few seats, two seats, I think, or maybe just one, but I think it's two. He put something in the Arab newspapers in Arabic to get votes. So the idea that you can have a coalition of Haredi Arab, a non-Zionist majority running the city, is certainly a possibility. So Mr. Eyes is not someone with a Kol Yisrael sentiment if he's wants to make a coalition with the Arabs. So what does Rav Chaim Moser write to him? Very simply, he says to him, this idea that you want to make this hashva'ah im ha'aravim, this I don't know how to translate hashva'ah to this, to get to go together with the Arabs, that is who? With B'shem Aguda, that is Agudas Yisrael should cast their lot with the Arabs. He says, this is in opposition to my opinion. Ki kol Yisrael arevim ze bazeh u'kadoshei chevron yochichu. This letter is written in 1937, and he says to him, all Jews are responsible one for the other. And in case, Mr. Eyes, you've forgotten or having any problems with this, Chevron teaches us. What does he mean, Chevron? Because the Arabs didn't care about the Zionists there. The Arabs in Chevron killed everyone. They killed yeshiva students. They killed Jews, qua Jews. So here, Mr. Eyes, he wants to, have a Aguda join a coalition with the Arabs and in opposition to the Zionists when dealing with the British government. You know, remember, they're trying to, statehood is coming. What type of state it's going to be that the Aguda should appear together with the Arabs and they should, because their interests are aligned. And Rav Chaim Moser, can you imagine? You can never have an East European Jew say this. I don't care how extremist you are in Eastern Europe. Everyone in Eastern Europe would sense that, if even people like I mentioned sectarian Orthodox knew that a Jew was a Jew if it came to a matter such as this. I'm pretty convinced of that. But when you deal with Jews in Switzerland and Germany, they were so assimilated as it is. Even the Orthodox Jews were assimilated to a certain extent. They felt to themselves as Germans, as French, as English. That's where you get all the anti-Zionists among the Orthodox. In Western Europe, you get it because they were in Eastern Europe, it's because they thought it goes against God's plan, or the secularists would be running the show, and that's going to be bad for the Orthodox. For the Western European, including the Orthodox, the attitude is always, no, we're patriotic Germans, and therefore we don't want to have anything to do with this. So Rav Chaim Moser has to write to an Agudist in Western Europe that this is not a good idea, and that we do not accept this idea that we join together with the Arabs in opposition to other Jews. And all you have to do is look at Chevron, and you see the answer to that. And finally, on page 291, one letter to Rav Reuven Katz, also about the land of Israel. Rav Reuven Katz had written to Rav Chaim Moser because he had heard that that Rav Yaakov, he's not a rabbi even, he's Mr. Yaakov Rosenheim. He was also a layperson, one of the leaders of Aguda, in fact, the leaders of Aguda. He had been quoted in the newspapers as saying that the British white paper, in which they stopped immigration, that this was Dina de Malchusa Dina. That is, you have to follow the law of the land, which would have meant that all the, quote, illegal immigration, you couldn't do it. because you have to follow what the government says. And Reuven Katz was outraged by this. We already saw what he said about the British White Paper and how Britain, which the Jews had done so much for Britain during the war, and they had been given the opportunity to help the Jewish people. Instead, they, after the Balfour Declaration, they turned their back on the Balfour Declaration and closed the borders. And so clearly you don't need to follow the White Paper. So he asked Rosenheim, and Rosenheim replied that this is false. All Rosenheim said was that Ma'aseh HaBiryonim, terror, the Chayotzibo, that is the Irgun, the Lechi, the terrorist attacks against the British soldiers, that is against the law, and that is against Das Torah, and that could bring to great danger. And then Rav Chaim Ozer replies, and for this opinion, Hinenu Maskimi Kulanu, we all agree, as we saw with Reuven Katz as well. That, there's nothing controversial. We know that the rabbis were opposed to the actions of the Irgun and Lechi. And this, Shlomo, is the final thing I will say about Rav Reuven Katz, unless there's questions. In his book of Drashot, the Duda Reuven, take a look on page 217 if anyone's interested on the issue of Yifat Tovar. He's speaking about the matter of Yifat Tovar, the captive woman, that even Chazal have difficulty with it. They say that this is a sort of a commandment only against the Yetzer Hara. Chazal are telling you this isn't something to strive for. Chazal are saying basically what Rabbi Soloveitchik said, that halacha is the floor, not the ceiling, that you can follow halacha, but that doesn't mean you should stop there. That this isn't the proper thing to do, but it's only done against the Eitz Sahara. Rav Reuven uses even sharper language, though, I think, than what you see in Chazal. Listen to this. He says that in discussing the whole idea of Yifat Tovar, which from a modern perspective, I think the best thing you can say about it is it makes the best of a bad circumstance, that in those days people had no the Torah felt it had no choice but to compromise with people's surroundings, the way people lived, that soldiers were going to do this, so it tried to channel it a certain way. That's basically what Chazal were saying. Today, Rav Kook already writes about how something like this today has no significance, because today we would not, we're at a different level, and we would not put this into play, and that we would insist that there's no such thing as Yifat Tovar, that Rav Kook has this idea of developing morality, that in certain areas we get better, certain areas we get worse, but in certain areas that we no longer need to avail ourselves of a heter such as this. But look what Rav Reuven says. He refers to this as heter l'davar she'eino hagon u'musari. He says explicitly that, and he says that sometimes the Torah or halacha has to give a heter for something that is not ethical and not proper, because the other way would be even worse. But you have to know that this is not a moral thing, this is not an ethical thing, this is something that was tolerated, and you should strive to move beyond it. Rav Kook said we're already beyond it. I think this is significant. It's very interesting to use about Chazal don't use this language, although Rav Reuven says it's latent in Chazal, but to speak about a mitzvah in the Torah as not musari. You could say the same thing about slavery, I guess. You could expand this and say these were all, Rav Nachman Rabinovich writes about this, that these were all compromises. People were not going to get rid of their slaves, and therefore slavery was acknowledged, but made more humane. But still, for someone from the old school, an East European rabbi to use language like this is to me a little bit significant and worth noting. With that, I will end our discussions on Rav Reuven Katz. Found the most enjoyable. We learned a lot, and it took us over 5.5 times. If anyone has any questions, I'll take them on Rav Reuven. We're not done yet. We still have 20 more minutes, and I'm going to go right into the 50 more minutes. I'll introduce at least the Ben Ish Chai, but let me look at some of the comments first. Zalman's meat, Shlomo says. He says it was Zalman's meat, that was the one the Star K put the Hashgacha under. I don't know the politics of it and why. I remember a video where Rabbi Heinemann spoke and he tried to defend what they're doing, and he said that every single schlachthaus had non-kosher, because when you shechted, anything that was found non-kosher, it wasn't, they checked it out, the bodek, so then they kept it, they put it to the side, and then they sold it as treif. It didn't go to waste. So he said, what's the difference? Look, he has a good point, and that's the point of the Knesset Rabbanim. But that doesn't change the fact that there was a cheirim, a ban, and not a cheirim, a takana, and the Star K was in opposition to the takana. They violated the takana. I called the Star K after this because I was curious. I spoke to, maybe his name is Pollock, I forget, Avram Pollock, I think is the person I spoke to, because I wanted to point out first, because he spoke also in the video. First thing I wanted to do was point out the error, that Rabbi Heineman was completely wrong. That what he said is maybe correct, but is completely irrelevant to the Takana. They were absolutely in violation of the Takana, which everyone else knew. But I also then said to him, when I spoke to this, I think it was Pollock, but what's the big deal? Why can't Rabbi Heineman says he doesn't hold to the Takana? He holds to the Knesset Rabbanim, that the Takana is not binding. I said it tongue-in-cheek, because no one's heard of the Knesset Rabbanim. And when you have a takana that's been in existence now for 60, 70 years, reaffirmed by people like Moshe Feinstein in the 1980s, it's a little hard to go back on it. And the Star K folded. They had no choice to fold. And they were, it was a lot of double talk what they were saying, that they're not in violation of the takana. They were. Yisrael says, okay, Rabbi Kelman, I hear what you're saying. Okay, Yisrael asks, how does it happen that we get people this significant, but most of us have never heard of them? Does it all come down to Art Scroll's biography determining fame? It's an excellent question, Yisrael, and it has nothing really to do with Art Scroll, because Art Scroll didn't exist 30 years ago. Very few people make it, in the sense that they're heard of in future generations. What does it take to make it? Well, let's first remember that let's take the 18th century, for instance. There are certain great rabbis. You have the Noda Yehudi, the Vilna Gaon, the Yaakov Emden, Rav Yonasan Ivshitz, a couple others. There were hundreds of sarim published in the 18th century and many great rabbis, but you can't expect every generation to continue, listening to and following and hearing about the earlier ones. Every generation is a new generation. In terms of Torah students, there's a canon. There's so much Torah to learn. Why should anyone study a work other than, let's say, the Talmud and the Rambam? But certain works make it in. If you look in the 18th century, who makes it in? People, I said, the 19th century, the Chasam Sofer. Who makes it in the 20th century? Books are being published every day. How many works from 40 years ago are still studied today? The Igros Moshe is one of them. But, there's so much to learn, why let someone else, devote yourself to a recent work when you can study medieval works? That's normal. That's natural. Most great Torah scholars are going to be forgotten because some of them towered over their era. Enormously significant. But if they didn't do anything that was of lasting significance, if they were not institutional builders, Rav Aaron Cutler, for instance, had Rav Aaron Cutler not built Lakewood, who would remember him? He didn't really write anything, nothing, very little, he didn't write tshuvos or anything that were groundbreaking, so why would he be remembered? But he built Lakewood. So you're either remembered in two ways, either because of your influence as a posek or a rosh yeshiva, either halachically, or what you build. Most of these rabbis that we talk about were rabbis in cities, and they wrote volumes, but they were not groundbreaking. They were great Torah scholars, and think of in our own generation. Just think of the last generation, who the great Rosh Yeshiva were in the last generation. Other than Rabbi Soloveitchik or Moshe Feinstein, will any of them stand the test of time? In 100 years, is anyone going to hear of a Ruderman? He was a great Talmud Chacham, a great Rosh Yeshiva, but, Rabbi Svei, Rabbi Gifter? Unless you have something in print, and unless you really changed the direction of Halacha or of Jewish history, there's no reason to remember them. Has anyone heard of Rav Yosef Chaya Stern? Who was greater in his generation, Rav Yosef Chaya Stern? These were great rabbis, and that's just the way it is. But that's natural. That's normal. The Aderis. The Aderis in the early 20th century. Who was greater than the Aderis? When I was in Boston, I learned at the Lakewood Kollel there. And I once brought a sefer in. I just was learning the sefer, and my chavrusa, who had been in Lakewood probably 15 years, he had high school, yeshiva, now he's in kollel, so he's been in the Lakewood world for about 15 years, I would think. He asked me what the sefer was, and I showed it to him. It was a book called Zecher Yehosef by Rav Yosef Zachariah Stern, volume of Tshuvot.
he had never heard of Rav Yosef Zacharia Stern. Rav Yosef Zacharia Stern was regarded as the greatest bucky, the greatest, most erudite of all. He was the Ravad Yosef of 100 years ago. And yet today, someone whose entire life has been in the yeshiva world. But that's because the yeshiva world canon is very small, as we know. We've spoken about this many times. Rav Chaim Palachi. In the Sephardic world, who's greater than Rav Chaim Palachi? Other than, you know, now you have Rav Avad Yosef, but before Rav Avad Yosef, you have the Ben Ishchai and Rav Chaim Palachi. How many people have heard of him in the Ashkenazic world? What's interesting is why the Ben Ishchai seemed to have made it into the Ashkenazic world. We're going to have to reflect a little bit about that as we go through our classes in the Ben Ishchai. A couple other questions? Let's see. There is, I don't know what Shlomo means when he says there is one, everyone knows him. Yisrael says, what makes Rav Moshe write volumes and volumes and the Rav next to nothing? The Rabbi Soloveitchik came from Brisk, and in Brisk, they had this tradition not to publish. Unless you were absolutely certain about something, most people publish, you put forth ideas. In Brisk, they didn't believe in publishing unless you were absolutely certain of what you said was the Torah truth. Reb Chaim himself did not publish his writings at all. In Reb Chaim's lifetime, enormous amount was published from him, but never by Reb Chaim, all from students. That's how his reputation spread to a certain extent. After his death, they published it. Revelvel Soloveitchik also, I mean, we're not talking about very much. Reb Soloveitchik did publish. He did not publish very much, but he did publish some things. Now enormous amounts are being published. But that's just an approach. That's just a tradition. Most people do not have that. And also, the Briskers were not halacha lemaisa people. Rav Moshe Feinstein was writing responsa. He became famous because of the responsa. Rav Soloveitchik didn't write responsa. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik didn't write responsa. Rav Elvel didn't write responsa. Rav Moshe didn't write responsa. It's not their family tradition to write responsa. Shlomo, before we go further, if you can just tell me who everyone knows him. I'm going down. Okay, I see it now. You're going to have to write in, Shlomo, what the segula of Koyin's Erev Shavuos is. I don't know. Rabbi Scott Berman says that he remembers stories shared by Rabbi David Silver about his father, Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who would show up to a shlacht house with both kosher and non-kosher shechting and catch them putting pombos on non-kosher animals. He, by the way, Rabbi Eliezer Silver was head of the Agudas Rabbanim, so he would not get along with people like Rabbi Yudel Levitz. And that was precisely why they said you can't have non-kosher and kosher together. Of course you're going to have non-kosher animals after you shech them, but those were, not only did you put them aside, they would have this like a paint that they put on them. So the animal, the skin of the animal would have this like red paint put on it, so everyone would know that that's treif. That you can't avoid. And they'd have a special place where they put these animals. As soon as they declared a treif, they would mark it. But to have a schlachthaus in which one section of it is continuously making treif, that the Agudas Rabbanim said no. Those who are interested in reading, as I said, look at Gassword's book. The mafia, the Jewish mafia, got involved with this as well. Things got so bad that at the Ramaz, Moshe Zev Margolius's daughter's wedding. Yes, it was his daughter's wedding. They poisoned the food to try to kill him and try to assassinate him. The Ridbaz, they put him inside a, apparently, I don't think they say it's an attempt to assassinate him. I don't think so. I think it was just to scare him. They locked him in the freezer to scare him off, because when he went to Chicago, if you recall the classes on the Ridbaz, there was great machlokus over this. The mafia, the Jewish mafia was involved. The non-Jewish mafia was involved. The machlokus was unbelievable. There was a rabbi named Mendelssohn who was involved with the Knesset Rabbanim. He was the rabbi in Newark who feuded with the Ridbaz's son-in-law, Rabbi Konvitz, who was the head of Agudas Rabbanim, one of the heads. And Mendelssohn was with the, he wrote a volume of Tshuvos called the, what's it called? Something Yavetz, Mishnas Yavetz. And he writes about, in there he has a tshuva about Rabbi Konvitz, whose name was, his son was Milton Konvitz, the professor. His father's name was, I forgot, it's with a Yud, Yaakov Konvitz, I forget what it was, his first name, someone will type it in. he refers to him as Reik, Reish Yud Kuf. And that's how he calls him, that this Rabbi Reik. Reik, it's a play on Reish Yud Kuf. Yosef Konvitz, that's his name. And Reik also means empty, ignorant. So that's how he called him. I forgot exactly what he did, but he was fined by the government $100,000 for breaking some law regarding to kashrus. So it's a wonderful story, and it showed Orthodox Jews and their rabbis not at their best, but to be Mohammed Schuss, this was really pikuach nefesh for these people. This was their life. Without the shlita and without the hashkachas, these people, they would have starved. This was their parnassah. So when people are fighting over parnassah, they do a lot of distasteful things. Rabbi Aaron Rekefet tells the following story. I forget which rabbi it was, but it was he went to a funeral of another rabbi, one of the old-time rabbis. And in the hesped, a rabbi gets up, who gives the hesped. Oh, again, one of these are Agudas Yisrael Rabbanim, old-time rabbis, and he says about the deceased rabbi that he could not be bought. Even if you offered him $1 million, you couldn't buy him. Just think of this. Here you're at a hesped for a rav, a European payish rav, and as part of the hesped, someone says he couldn't be bought. You can't imagine saying that about a rabbi. People would think that's the most disrespectful thing. Of course a rabbi can't be bought. But as Rabbi Rekefet explained, so many rabbis were either bought or thought to have been bought, and the Yetzer Hara was always there because they had no money, that to get up at a funeral, let's say this is in the 1960s, and to say about a rabbi who made his living working in the slaughterhouses that he couldn't be bought, to look the other way, that was regarded as a kavod. I think that's quite telling. I already see we're not going to get to the Ben Ishchai, so we're going to start with the Ben Ishchai beginning next semester. And that's probably best because we can pull in maybe some of the Iraqis. We'll devote a good deal of time to the Ben Ishchai. We'll start fresh and bring in all those Moroccans, those Tunisians, all the Sephardim. Why do I say all the Sephardim? Because although Iraq is really not Sephardic, we don't consider it Sephardic in the sense that we distinguish between those Edot Mizrach, those who live there, and the ones who come from Spain. Nevertheless, the Ben Ishchai, as we'll see, had a great influence in the entire, quote, Sephardic world. But in the meantime, in the time we have left, let me finish off with some of the questions. Those who are interested, by the way, in Rabbi Silver, and since I mentioned Rekefet, you can see his book on both Bernard Revel and on Eliezer Silver and his material on this. Yisrael says, it seems that two generations ago there were many great scholars. A generation ago, many but less, and now just a handful. Is that a fair statement? Not really, because every generation doesn't take its own scholars that seriously. In later generations, we look back and we think that they were greater. It is true that we had more scholars then. That is true. However, don't think that they were treated any better than our scholars are treated today. More Sfarim were published then. That I can tell you. But rabbis are actually treated better today in America than they were treated 80 years ago. And we do have great geniuses today and great scholars, but they're in Israel for the most part. We have some in America. We have great Torah scholars and great poskim in America as well, but the center of Torah scholarship is now in Israel. So I could give you 20 names of figures who I would consider great figures just in the land of Israel. So if you go back to the early part of the 20th century, I could give you 20 names as well. Other figures would be second-level rabbis. Rabbi Yudel Levitz, in terms of Torah knowledge, I'm told that he should be up in the first level, that is, in the top 20. I'm not going to say the top 10, but in the top 20. Shlomo says, Reb Chaim Palachi is speaking about it. I don't know anything about the Segula of Coins, Erev Shavuot, so I can't tell you. What I can say is that Reb Chaim Palachi, who published something like 100 books, Rav Avadya Yosef has really made him popular. He was forgotten, not just in the Ashkenazic world. He was never forgotten in the Ashkenazic world. They never knew him. He was forgotten in the Sephardic world. It was Rav Avadya Yosef who brought him in. And what's the proof of this? And this was pointed out to me correctly by Rabbi Avadya Hoffman, who also listens to the classes. Just look at the Sephardic works 40 years ago. Who's quoting Rav Chaim Palachi? No one. And Rav Avadya Yosef starts quoting him, and the works are reprinted, and he is important. He was the chief rabbi of Izmir, of Smyrna. the equivalent of the Chacham Bashi, and the leading scholar in Turkey, so he should have a revival. Yisrael says Rav Moshe wrote Dibros Moshe, a very large quantity. If writing helps secure a legacy, did the Rav not care about being remembered? The Rav wrote, he just didn't publish it. So the Rav didn't publish his Chidushei Torah. I can't answer it. It's a good question. Not everyone sees publishing as the be-all and end-all. Perhaps the Rav knew that posthumously the material would be published. He didn't publish Chidushim. You're right. He published articles of Torah articles. He didn't publish on the tractates. Instead, you have Rabbi Reichman and others who put out the volumes. I don't know. It's some people are just like that. And the Rav is not the only one. Take a look at Yeshiva University today. I mentioned Yeshiva only because many of us have some connection to it. You have Rav Herschel Schechter who publishes Torah, and you have a few other Rosh Yeshiva who publish, but you have other Rosh Yeshiva who don't publish a thing. That's just not, they have Chidushim, but it's just some people are driven. Rav Herschel Schechter, since his youth, has been driven, apparently, to write and to publish. Others, not so much. And that was also the case in the previous years. You had Rosh Yeshiva there from the old school, Rabbi Volk and others, Burak, Paleoff, who published, and others who never published. I can tell you in academia, we have people who don't publish either. And then there's people who do. So Yisrael asks, Shlomo, we're getting to the end, says that Kupatayir advertised Rechaim Palachi to give 104 coins to them on Erev Shavuos. That's obviously a segula. I didn't know that segula. So now everyone knows him. I know that there's another segula they have. Maybe it's the Chida. So all Haredi Jewry knows him. Yisrael asks, does the Haredi world have more great scholars than the modern Zionist? If you ask, does the Haredi world have quantitatively more scholars? Yes. I would have to say that quantitatively, there are more scholars because there are more people studying Torah in advanced levels in the Haredi world. But if you're asking me qualitatively, do they have, the answer is no. The Lithuanian world has more qualitative quantity, has more Torah scholars than the Satmar world also. But I'm not going to say qualitatively they do. So that to me never bothered. That never has bothered me. Because if you have 20 people you could say are great scholars, and the religious Zionist world maybe only has 10, but if those 10 are the equivalent, and I would say greater, for a variety of reasons, more leaders, more of a Torah leader, the way we need, than the other 10 of the top Haredi leaders, what does it matter? I mean, Yisrael, you wrote the article on the Rav. One Rabbi Soloveitchik equals 10 other Rosh Yeshiva. So in terms of quantity, that's not what's important. It's in terms of quality. And the Torah scholarship that comes out of the religious Zionist yeshivas is the equivalent of the Haredi yeshivas. Furthermore, I've said this and I'll say it again, man for man, the religious Zionist world, their people are better than the Haredi world. Simply because in the Haredi world, it's a lifestyle. And then probably half the people in the Haredi yeshivas are just batlin nizman there because cultural, societal reasons, they have to be there. Every single person in the religious Zionist yeshivas knows he's there. He doesn't have to be there. He chooses to be there, and he knows he's there for a limited time, and they make the most out of it. When you're there because you want to be there, and it's important to you, you make the most out of it. So man to man, I would take the top scholars of the religious Zionist world, not just the equivalent, even better than in the Haredi world, because the Haredi world, as I said, it's a cultural thing. There are great scholars in the Haredi world, of course, but qualitatively, if you look at the, take a look at Yeshivas Birkas Moshe and Mali Adumim, the Ramim there, every single one of them, qualitatively, are the equivalent of everyone else. So then you could ask the question, Yisrael, so then how come all this talk is about the Gedolim, Rabbi Steinman and others, and you don't hear about Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein? I mean, he's a great Torah scholar, but you know, don't think of him as the Gadol, Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich. And that's all propaganda. That's all politics. In the Haredi world, they've invented this thing of the Gadol Hador. So they crown people Gadol Hador, and they make a big deal, and they put them on these pedestals. If Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein was in the Haredi world, they'd make him the God of Hadar. It's just that we're in a different world. Maybe their world is better in that sense. Maybe we should take these Gedolim and put them on these pedestals. But I can tell you that people like Avraham Lichtenstein, Rav Nachum Rabinowitz, and all these great Rebbe Zionist figures are qualitatively the equal of these figures, like Rabbi Steinman, Rav Shmuel Auerbach, all these figures who get all this airtime, all this, Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg. Is there anyone in Israel who's greater than Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg? He's not in any of the placards. He doesn't have Das Torah. He doesn't do anything because he's not in that world. But I think we're mature enough to understand that while we can respect these other great rabbis, not to fall into this the Gadol Hador, the Posek Hador, they've created this idea. Nowhere in the Talmud, nowhere in the Rambam, nowhere in halachic literature until 40 years ago, do you have an office known as a Posek Hador. That's something they invented, and they invented it precisely in order to create this hierarchy so that anyone else is outside. And we don't accept that. Simple as that. Yisrael says, if an Iraqi is not Sephardi, what is he? Well, we call him Sephardi. And you say, you thought it was just Ashkenazi and Sephardi. Well, what about Yemenite? Don't forget about Yemenite. The Iraqi Jewish community goes back until the days of the Talmud. They're descendants from Babylonia. And their tradition is one tradition. Then you had the Spanish tradition. And the Spanish tradition is very different. And North Africa, by the way, North Africa is also indigenous communities, but many of these communities in Morocco, for instance, when the Spanish exiles came, they took over. And then there's the Italian community. The Italian has their own minhags. So we put Sephardim in one rubric. We also include Yemenite. The Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel supposedly represents the Yemenites. And the Yemenite tradition is very different than the Sephardic tradition. We put them all under one rubric, but the minhagim, the practices of Moroccan Jew, are very different than the practices of the Iraqis. Let's see. I don't know. I see one Sephardic name here, Jonathan. I don't know if he's Moroccan or he'll maybe write in if he's Moroccan or not. But does anyone know? I'll tell you. Do you know that Moroccan Jews don't eat rice on Pesach? Not just Moroccan Jews. North African Jews don't. So when you make a statement, for instance, that Sephardim can eat rice on Pesach, it's not true. It's some Sephardim do, some Sephardim don't. They're very different. Sephardim. Doesn't everyone know that Sephardim have to keep Beit Yosef? They have to keep Gak Kosher? If there's anything that Rav Ovadia Yosef was involved with, it's pushing this point. They never had Glatt Kosher in North Africa. They didn't have it in Syria. In America, the Syrians never ate Glatt Kosher until about 20-some years ago. Yes, you did have Sephardim who followed the Shulchan Aruch in the land of Israel, who insisted on Beit Yosef, what we call Glatt. But not all Sephardim did. So Sephardim in Morocco and Iraq are just as different in many areas as Ashkenazim in Germany and in Poland. Polish minhag is not the old minhag Ashkenaz of the Mahariel and everything like that. Yeah, Bill says he published the Ortsite Shirim, the Rav Soloveitchik. He did, and he published in Hapardes. He published enough articles in Hapardes that Machon Yerushalayim put them out in a nice little that blue volume there. I think it's called Kovetz Mamarim or something like that. So Jonathan's Moroccan. I don't know. Jonathan, do you eat rice? I'm not sure. But it could be, even in Morocco, there were different practices. In the north part of Morocco, a place like Tetouan, they had different practices than you have, for example, in Marrakesh and other. Yisrael asks, he heard the Rav tried to play a role in rescuing Rafutner. What was his role? I don't know, because I never heard that before. Yes, but Jonathan, even if your mother's Ashkenazic, the minhag is supposed to go by the father. So even if you don't eat rice, you could definitely eat other forms of kidney oat. In theory, okay. Well, look, I just want to, we're basically at the end here. I want to thank all of you, those who are with me live right now, those who are going to be listening by the tape later this week, God willing, for joining us for another semester. Not sure how many semesters we've had already. We're up to, I think this is our 142nd class. At least we're at the number 142. We did good stuff this semester. I thank you again for all your comments or questions. I really thought that, I know you're going to make fun of me here, Shlomo, or make a joke, but I thought that we do Revue Van Cats in 3 classes. It took us 5 classes, but I hope, and based upon the comments, I think I am correct in saying that you did find it interesting that we opened up an angle of Torah history. No one has really given classes ever on Revue Van Cats. Revue Van is one of these forgotten figures that Yisrael Kashkin alluded to. So I hope you enjoyed it, and you're welcome, Eva. I wish you all a very good Pesach, and hopefully we will pick up again after Pesach. If anyone has any further comments or questions, send them to me, and I'll be happy to bring them up when we meet again. Have a Chag Kosher V'Sameach, everyone. Good night.